This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about communication between doctors and patients, or I might better say miscommunication at times between doctors and patients. The book is What Doctors Say, What Patients Hear, by Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's a practicing physician at Bellevue. She teaches medical students and doctors about better ways to communicate. And Dr. Ofri, one big issue is health literacy. You know, surveys show that a lot of patients don't really understand what's going on in a doctor-patient interaction. I think I read a statistic that something like only 12% of the population is, quote, proficient in health literacy. I'm not sure what the criteria are for that, but that's a scary statistic.
I agree that it's quite a concern. And you know, we often give patients, we barrage them with information. You know, here's the 27 things you need to do for this, you know, particular illness, and here are the 16 foods you can or can't eat, and here's a list of 25 medications. Right. And then we patient comes up and says, oh, you know, they're non-compliant, right? And I always give the image of, imagine like traveling in a country like, let's say, Thailand or Burma, a place where, you know, the language has nothing in common with English or any European language, and then getting sick and trying to navigate your way in a place that you don't know the culture or the language and it's not familiar, you probably wouldn't get it all right. And so I think we have to recognize that for our patients, it can feel like that. And also because, as we mentioned before, that when patients are there, they're not necessarily in their sharpest moment because they're at that time are typically worried about something or they're in pain. And when you're in pain, it's very hard to catch all the nuances. And forget if you're, you know, have a fever to 104 or you're throwing up. I mean, it's very difficult to pull that on. So I think we have to recognize that we may throw a lot of information at a patient and they may only be catching about 10% of that.
Indeed. And here's another problem that I think really creates difficulty during the doctor-patient encounter is that doctors tend to think out loud. Almost as if, you know, remember those sessions where we had to do differential diagnosis and the chief of medicine was standing right there sternly trying to get us to recite all the possibilities. So doctors sometimes think out loud in front of patients to the detriment of the encounter. And they may say, and this is actually brought to mind when I saw recently one of my favorite movies, Hannah's Sisters, which is a Woody Allen movie. And Woody Allen, in this movie, of course, he's a hypochondriac. He's in real life, he's a hypochondriac too. But he he develops some like vague symptoms, like some mild dizziness ringing in his ears, and he goes to various doctors. And finally, he goes to a doctor who says, "Well, you know, it could be nothing. It could be something. It could, of course, be a brain tumor." You know, and he's going through, and doctors do that. They tend to play the rule out game, and to play the rule out game in front of patients. Sometimes it's not the best idea because this is not an academic exercise. This is a doctor-patient communication.
Right. Right. Yeah, indeed. And I remember that movie well. And so I think it's important to do the differential in your head. Think about, you know, you don't want to mention the brain tumor in every patient who comes in with a twinge, even though you're right, maybe one in a million has a brain tumor. But if it's unlikely, bringing it up may actually, you know, frighten a patient more. And so I think we have to be realistic. You know, here are the realistic possibilities and don't need to bring up, you know, good pasture syndrome or some rarer disease that is unlikely to be the case.
And conversely, doctors have a lot of trouble expressing bad news. You know, like telling bad news is, first of all, it's one of your unfavorite things to do as a doctor. But there's an art to it, right? You know, and I think you probably do some work with your residents and your medical students on how to communicate bad news.
Yeah, and the best way to teach this is to demonstrate it. So bringing, you know, the team in to the bedside when you're about to, you know, talk to a patient, for example, about a diagnosis of cancer or, you know, an end-stage disease, or in a patient with cancer shifting from care that has curative intent to care that it was palliative intent. And these are difficult conversations. And again, one of the most important things to try to demonstrate is to first ask the patient what they understand of the situation thus far. Get a sense of what they know, where they stand, what the areas of confusion are, and then to begin, you know, telling it in small, gentle bits, and not to throw on 100 things at once, because you want to get a sense because you want to get a sense of how much the patient is ready and able to absorb. Mm-hmm. And some patients can take in, you know, the whole plan at once, and some patients need a little bit at a time, and you want to feel that out bit by bit.
You get a little bit of what I call the deer in the headlights experience with patients, is once you say cancer or once you say HIV, it's almost like their mental processes stop, and you can drone on for another several minutes about how you plan to treat it, but they need some time to absorb the impact. Perhaps that may be a series of meetings.
Yeah, and sometimes we saw a mass on the skin. When we look at the mass, it turned out to be a tumor, and the digital cancer a little bit, you know, I walk and say, oh, you have cancer. You know, go into it slowly. And then I also ask patients, how much detail would you like to know? And not everyone wants every gory detail. Some patients want it all, but some will say, you know, I just want the basic outlines. And for the details, you know, my wife or my husband or my adult child. And that's okay. You know, someone can make the choice. They don't have to. And we want patients to make an informed decision, but you don't have to be assaulted by a detail. Because if you don't want, and if you want someone else to be the decision maker, or to be, you know, in charge of the nitty gritty, that's okay too, because you can really harm someone if they're not ready or able to take on. But as long as they make their own decision about that, then I'm comfortable with it.
You know, what's interesting, even in this era of patient empowerment, I read a survey where they said that still to this day, over half, 52% of patients preferred that physicians make the final decision. However, that does not mean that they don't want to be informed of the choices and the thinking process behind the decision. They still, 90% of patients, they want that information. They'll still go with their physician's choice. They still want their physician to tell them to make sure. It's not like, I mean, sometimes they say, well, you have prostate cancer. Well, decide, would you like surgery? Would you like radiation? Then they'll throw it back to the patient to the doctor, and then say, well, doctor, what do you think? Because I'm with you. You know, you're the one who's going to make the decision.
Yeah, I agree. I think we talk about patient autonomy. It often gets, you know, contorted to, well, you're the patient, decide what you want to do. And that's abandonment, right? The patient should make the decision, but you as the doctor have to be the advocate. And if the choices are not equal in efficacy, then it's your, you know, responsibility to make that clear. There's two choices. The effectiveness of them differ, or the side effect profiles differ. And you can even say, if you have a strong opinion, this is what I recommend. And there are reasons why you might want to do the other course of action. Here's why. So I think as a physician, you do be an advocate if one course is truly better than another. But again, listening is a big part of it. You know, you ask the patient, what are your goals, you know, for the treatment of this illness? And they may be different than the doctor's goals. I mean, for some patients, you know, it's getting to a cure no matter what, and they'll endure whatever hellish course of treatment. And for some patients, that is not worth it. Mm-hmm. Some patients will say, I do not want to suffer. And if my life ends 5 months earlier, that's okay. I don't want to spend my last few days, you know, puking up my guts out in the bathtub. I want to spend my days as comfortable as possible, even if it shortens my life. And we need to hear that.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most problematic areas in doctor-patient communication is concerns this particular audience, because this is a program that comprises lots of natural medicine approaches, vitamins, supplements, yoga, tai chi, you know, stress reduction, relaxation, alternative therapies, which I prefer to call integrative or complementary therapies, is when a patient comes to a doctor and says, well, I'm interested in doing X, Y, or Z natural therapy. And the doctor is contemptuous. The doctor is, you know, either ignorant or outright dismissive of the patient's desire to pursue alternative care. Now, there may be some real concerns there. There may be some things that the patient's doing that may potentially interfere with natural therapy, or maybe a natural therapy is inferior to a conventional therapy. And the doctor, I think, is within his or her purview to admonish the patient that maybe it's imprudent to do this natural therapy in lieu of conventional therapy. But this is a big problematic area. What? How do you handle that when you teach young doctors how to communicate with patients who are coming from there?
Again, like any issue that comes up, the best thing is to ask the patient what their thoughts are about this, what their concerns, what their goals are, why they're pursuing this, rather than come right out and say, I think this is a terrible idea or I think it's a great idea. I want to ask the patient, why are they pursuing this? What are they hoping to gain from that? And again, their goals for that may be different than what I think the goals for alternative therapy are. And what are they getting out of, you know, either the practitioner they're visiting or the medications they're taking? And then to the best of my ability, I'll try to see what evidence there is. I mean, very often, there's not a lot of evidence. These just simply haven't been tested. So I'll tell them, you know, it may or may not be harmful. There really isn't much data out here. So, you know, it's a little bit of unknown territory. And again, it depends on the situation. If they're taking, you know, something that's known to be a plant product for a mild condition, I would say it's probably unlikely to be harmful. But if they're taking something that's known to be toxic, or they're taking it in lieu of their Plavix for their recent stent, then I'll say, you know, listen, you know, your risk of damage is very high. And I talk about how, you know, many of our medications come from plants and natural products, and so they can overlap. And many natural products are poisonous. You know, arsenic is natural too, but we wouldn't want to take that. So you still need to be very careful. And the last thing I let patients know is that the things that are in, you know, supplement bottles often aren't regulated in the way that medications are. So when it says 10 milligrams of XYZ supplement, it may contain that, but you don't know. You know, it may come from some, you know, place in a developing world that may be putting anything in there. So you just need to be careful. Not saying it's necessarily bad, but like anything you put into your body, you should be very careful and not assume anything that's, quote, natural is safe and harmless.
I'll put in a plug at this point for my type of practice, which is that, you know, I try to curate the products which I think are of the greatest purity and potency and conform to the best standards, because it is a bit of a free fire zone when it comes to supplement quality. And certain manufacturers are reputable and others are not, so patients have to be careful. So
I warn patients, a lot of internet advertised things, you know, are really money-making scams, and to be very careful. And there's plenty of allopathic, you know, doctors who run scams too. But just to be careful on any front. And if someone promises you something that seems too good to be true, it probably is. Like if there was a 10-day cure for losing 50 pounds or curing cancer, you know, I would hope the medical science was aware of that. So if you see that on there, it's probably not true, because, you know, most things don't happen that way, no matter what you do.
Well, as you know, it's a conspiracy on the part of you doctors and the drug companies to maintain their profits by perpetuating cancer, heart disease, you know the rap, right?
Gotcha. Well, that's one reason that I love to be a salary doctor at City Hospital, because I can say quite clearly, you know, I don't make any money off any of that. You know, I get my, you know, my paycheck, whether or not you take this medication or do that.
And no vested interest, yeah.
No vested interest in anything. And that my advice to you will be the best advice I can give you. But sure, I mean, if you read about, you know, Purdue Pharma and oxycodone, and you can see why people would think about conspiracies, because there is a lot of there is a lot of, you know, muckraking in big pharma. So if they're not completely off by that, but yeah, it's hard to often distinguish between the real, you know, conspiracies and the fake ones.
Indeed. So, you know, there are issues of physician bias too. You know, one of the things that physicians bring to the table is bias. And we're not just talking about classical racial bias, you know, like a white supremacist doctor who doesn't want to treat minorities. That's, you know, probably they're few and far between, but bias against demanding patients, biased against patients who are non-compliant, bias against obese patients. I mean, many doctors, you know, they're into physical fitness, they're slim, they're trim, they run marathons. They see a patient who's obese, and you know, maybe they're going to turn off some of their therapeutic faculties in the face of what seems like a self-induced problem by that patient.
It's a very prevalent problem, and as you said, the sort of explicit bias. That's luckily fairly rare, but the implicit bias that we aren't even aware of is quite prevalent. And we can see that study after study shows that underrepresented minorities tend to get less aggressive treatment for cancer and less pain treatment and less heart disease treatment. So it's quite rampant, and it, you know, goes toward women, toward minority, toward people with seemingly self-induced issues. And implicit bias is very hard to eradicate. So one step is even just being aware that we all have implicit biases, and it doesn't make you a bad person, it makes you a person. And the first step is to try to become aware of when you might be biased. And so if you look at the name of a patient coming in, you haven't seen them, and you say, oh, and the name triggers something in you, either the name represents an ethnicity or a racial group that you roll your eyes at for whatever reason it is, or you know this patient to be non-compliant or obese or demanding, and try to say, okay, take a deep breath, try to put that aside, and remember that they're probably experiencing a lot of pain. And a good analogy is having a teenager in your home, which I now have, and teenagers can be very difficult. And I try to remember when my teen is, you know, cursing like a sailor or, you know, all that negative stuff, to remember that usually reflects their own inner pain, confusion, and hurt. And it comes out as this difficult, annoying, push your buttons kind of aggression. And so when my patient is demanding pain meds or, you know, being provocative or demanding, try to remember that it's reflective of something that they're struggling with, pain or their illness or whatever it is, and try to see if you can, you know, get 5 degrees of empathy for what their life must be like and or what their situation might be like or how they got into this addiction or the stress the addiction brings to them. That can help you sort of reset from the world, get rid of it completely. But if we can at least have it on our radar that we're prone to that, and then just think for a second, what if that were my mother or my child who was afflicted with any of these difficult-to-treat prickly conditions? How would you want their doctor to treat them?
Indeed, that's a great mental exercise to undergo. You know, you do something as a sideline, which is quite interesting. You've initiated, and I think you still head up, something called the Bellevue Literary Review, which is a place where doctors can submit fiction and poetry. And this is sort of an increasing movement within medicine, is to include the humanities within medicine. But, you know, medicine's all about science, right? It's supposed to be, you know, we're supposed to be great chemists and organic chemists and, you know, mathematicians. So how does this help doctors be better doctors?
Well, there's two things that I'll separate here. So one is, yes, many medical journals invite doctors to submit poetry and fiction, because I think that the poetry and fiction often have much more in common with how we actually practice medicine than the big clinical trials. I mean, those clinical trials are important, but our patients don't walk in as clinical trials. They walk in as a person with a story. And I think the popularity of these sections reflects that most medicine is about human beings, individual stories and emotions. The Bellevue Literary Review is a journal about health and healing, but it's open to the general public. So the writers, while a few might be physicians, the vast majority are not. They're writers, patients, thinkers of any stripe from all over the world and from all walks of humanity who have been grappling with how our bodies and minds work or don't work. Because I think when you're a patient or have been part of the medical system, you recognize that the scientific part of treating medicine, that's a big part of, you know, getting better or healing, but it's only one part. And it's very conceivable to have your disease cured but not feel healed, to not come out of an experience feeling whole again. And exploring those aspects is where the humanities really shine. You know, the ambiguity of facing disability and illness, how we deal with uncertainty, which is so much of being both a doctor or a patient. So the Bellevue Literary Review has become is a journal for creative fiction, nonfiction, and poetry that grapple with these issues.
That's good stuff. And these days, I understand they encourage doctors in training to read the great literature of the world, to read, you know, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and, you know, major novelists, because in those novels are captured some of the same challenges and dilemmas, reactions to harsh circumstances that they encounter in daily practice.
And often these great works of literature will portray things in a memorable way that you can't get across with a PowerPoint. For example, you know, we talk about the importance of listening. You can put that up, you know, check one on the PowerPoint. But I often have my students, I try to get them to read the short story by Anton Chekhov entitled Misery. And Misery is about a Siberian taxi driver who's driving a sleigh in 19th century Siberia in the late night shift during Christmas. And he's taking these, you know, drunk partygoers back and forth from one party to the next. And with each customer, he tries to have a conversation. He wants to tell them about his young son who died that week, but no one takes him up in the conversation. And by the end of his shift, he hasn't been able to talk to anyone. So he parks the sleigh, he brings his horse back to the stable, and while he's brushing the horse, he tells the story to the horse. And the horse listens patiently, respectfully. And of course the horse can't answer, but it's enough for the horse to have listened. And I use this story to talk about the importance of bearing witness. We may not be able to solve our patients' greater psychosocial, economic issues, but listening, letting the patient tell the story and share their pain, and just being there to be the empathic listener is quite a lot. It's quite a lot right there. There's a lot of healing in that, and that's our role. And even if you can't solve it, just listen and recognize the act of humanity that you are performing.
Well, that's a great note to conclude on. I want to ask you if there are any resources besides your great book, which is What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, lots more detail in there, and some great anecdotes and stories are in that book. Any resources that patients can access? Are there websites, are there places that they should investigate?
Sure. So I keep all of my articles at danielleofrey.com. Including videos and articles about doctor-patient communication, medical humanities. And I do a monthly newsletter. If anyone's interested, they can sign up there. The Bellevue Literary Review has a website as well. And we do a medical humanities mailing list, which you can email us about. It's really wonderful, a collection of articles about dance and music and art and how it relates to health and healing. And NYU also has a literature, arts, and medicine database of great works of literature and art that relate to medicine.
Hmm. Wow. It's not the NYU I trained at, because it was all blood and guts and not a lot of additional, window dressing, because I think it wasn't recognized I guess it was recognized. They just did not have the resources to come up with that component.
And I think our newer generation of doctors in training do want a larger context for what they're doing. I think social justice is very important, and recognizing discrimination and rectifying some of that, especially discrimination on behalf of the field of medicine. You know, many racially based experiments that the medical profession did in the past haunt our students, and they come with that history and that context and see medicine as a way to help rectify some of the errors in the past.
Well, let's do the best we can to preserve the idealism of a future generation of doctors, because they have a lot of challenges to meet. There's a lot of depersonalization. There's the challenge of electronic medical records, which further detract from the encounter. The time pressures, medicine is going to be challenging field going ahead. And also we can take some of the old hands, veteran doctors like myself, and we can improve their communication skills. that's going to make a big difference. And we can enlighten patients as to what they can do to be part of the team. They are partners with doctors in achieving health goals. So thank you very much for your great work. Thanks for being there and being a voice for a very important component of medicine.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Daniel Ofri, author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.